Is the Canadian election campaign being manipulated? How is mainstream media and social media contributing to an exodus of political candidates mid-campaign? What does the response of the RCMP and Elections Canada to electoral irregularities tell us about the health of Canadian democracy? Does the telephone fraud executed during the 2011 election campaign constitute a state crime against democracy? And could a similar effort be underway in the current 2015 election? On this week's Global Research News Hour, with the 2015 Canadian federal election mere days away, we spend the hour examining the undermining of Canadian democracy in recent elections. We'll hear from media analyst and former electoral candidate Leslie Hughes about candidates being attacked for past statements during an election campaign and who benefits from this phenomenon. Then we'll hear from University of Guelph Emeritus Professor and author Michael Kiefer about the research he conducted on the role of telephone fraud in altering the results of the 2011 election and its implications for the current election. On this week's program, Voter Suppression in Canada, conversations with Leslie Hughes and Michael Kiefer. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of October 16th, 2015. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. We can also now be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Google's Knowledge Graph, in case you didn't know, was the search engine's first attempt at becoming a purveyor of knowledge rather than just information. A smart search tool, if you will, designed to enhance the relevancy of search results by analyzing various facts, figures, and other data appropriate to a user's intended query. The Knowledge Vault builds upon this concept, but takes it another step further. By sorting through the actual content of websites to determine whether or not they fit the official narrative for the particular idea or concept presented, the Knowledge Vault will act as a type of knowledge gatekeeper in censoring out information and content deemed to be quote-unquote false. The Knowledge Vault promises to let Google answer questions like an oracle rather than a search engine, and even to turn a new lens on human history, wrote Hal Hodgson for New Scientist about the project. It is this latter statement that's deeply concerning, as Google now has the power to literally rewrite history by snubbing search content of which the powers that be disapprove, while approving only propaganda and other misinformation dubbed accurate. That comes from the article, Google Degenerates into Ministry of Truth. All knowledge must now be pre-approved by search algorithm, by Jonathan Benson. Posted October 14th, originally appearing at Natural News. It seems that the EU is being greatly affected by the actions of Vladimir Putin in Syria. Suddenly, the EU president, Jean-Claude Juncker, is saying that the EU must not let the US dictate their relationship with Russia. He has demanded a normalization of relations and, indirectly, the end of sanctions. Some time ago, the U.S. Vice President Joe Biden made it clear that the U.S. had urged the EU to impose the sanctions. Juncker's big backflip is confirming the statement made by Biden. It's hard to discern what's really going on in Juncker's mind. As late as March, Juncker was demanding the establishment of an EU army, which was expressly directed against Russia. Such a European army would, quote, give Russia the impression that we are seriously intending to defend European Union's values, unquote, Juncker said word for word back then. That comes from the article, EU cannot go on fighting Russia. We cannot have our relationship towards Russia dictated by Washington. EU Commission President. By Russia Insider, posted October 14th, originally appearing at German Economic News. Why has Barack Obama airdropped 50 tons of ammunition into areas that moderate rebels in Syria supposedly control? Much of this ammunition will end up in the hands of those that the Russians are attempting to bomb into oblivion. And so to Russia, it appears that we are attempting to make their job much harder. And of course, the truth is that there aren't really any moderate rebels in Syria at all. At the end of the day, the U.S. supports just about anyone that wants to get rid of the Assad regime, and the Russians are working very hard to keep Assad in power. Just like the civil war in Ukraine, the conflict in Syria is in great danger of being transformed into a proxy war between the United States and Russia, and many fear that these conflicts could eventually be setting the stage for World War III. That comes from the article, Is Barack Obama Actually Trying to Start World War III? By Michael Snyder, posted October 15th, originally appearing in the Economic Collapse blog. From the moment the airliner was shot down, the U.S., NATO, and Ukraine have used the incident to indict Russia, and more specifically, Russian President Vladimir Putin, in the court of public opinion. It has used legal maneuvering and its well-oiled press to turn the investigation of the disaster into a witch hunt, with an inevitable outcome already eagerly determined to implicate Russia. The Western media has intentionally twisted the words of investigators to misrepresent evidence and preliminary and very cautious statements to portray them as definitive conclusions to establish Russia's guilt. Considering the lengths the U.S. and its allies have gone through to deceive the world regarding their crimes against the state of Syria, and considering the gain they have already wrought from exploiting the MH17 disaster, one must question the wisdom and reasoning of the West to go through such extraordinary lengths to at best portray Russia and Eastern Ukrainian fighters as guilty of accidentally shooting down an airliner flying over an active battlefield it should never have been directed over in the first place. What is more likely to play out later this month is that the exhausted credibility of the U.S. and its partners, both politically and across the media, will fail to sway public opinion or the facts on the ground in Ukraine in any shape, form, or way, regardless of the conclusions of the MH17 DSB and JIT investigations. That comes from the article, The MH17 Malaysian Airlines Crash from Syria to Ukraine When Lying Catches Up, by Olson Gunnar, posted October 14th, originally appearing at New Eastern Outlook. Who exactly is going to get their hands on those 50 tons of munitions? The Russian Defense Ministry has reported that, quote, Russian airstrikes resulted in the elimination of the majority of ISIS ammunition, heavy vehicles, and equipment, unquote. This joins numerous other positive reports on the Russian intervention, where we hear 40% of the terrorists' infrastructure has been eliminated and the launch of cruise missiles caused an exodus among the ranks of ISIS. Despite canceling their rebel training program, the U.S. has now airdropped 50 tons of ammunition for small arms along with grenades into the ISIS hotbed of northern Syria. That comes from the article, U.S. airdrops 50 tons of ammo to rebels after ISIS loses most supplies in Russian airstrikes, by Stuart Hooper, posted October 15th, originally appearing at 21st Century Wire. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Well, the longest election campaign in modern Canadian history is about to come to an end. The campaign has been remarkable for its use of wedge issues and identity politics. Issues such as whether or not Muslim women should wear face coverings at citizenship ceremonies have strangely emerged as dominant election narratives, while questions surrounding sustainable health care, pensions, sustainable environment, and impacts of the recently agreed-to Trans-Pacific Partnership remain underexamined. What's more, there's been a rash of candidates ejected from their respective parties in the wake of revelations of past statements they've made on social and other media that could potentially prove embarrassing to the party leaders. Do these developments pose a challenge to our traditional democratic practices? Leslie Hughes is an award-winning journalist, broadcaster, media trainer, speaker, and humorist based in Winnipeg. She ran as a Liberal candidate in the North Winnipeg constituency of Kildonan St. Paul. When she was asked to step down after an anonymous blogger posted an article of hers written in 2002 suggesting U.S. and Israeli foreknowledge of the 9/11 terror attacks, thus resulting in her being branded an anti-Semitic 9/11 conspiracy theorist. Leslie Hughes joins us now. She is also the author of an upcoming book detailing her experiences in that campaign. So, Leslie Hughes, thank you very much for joining us on the Global Research News Hour.
Always a pleasure, Michael.
Okay, so I was wondering if you could just maybe very, very briefly expand a little bit on what I've just said about your own candidacy and the circumstances under which you were ejected.
Well, as you put it, an anonymous blogger labeled me a conspiracy fool, a truther, which of course is a very controversial thing to say about anyone, and probably most importantly, anti-Semitic. And this blogger was anonymous, and those claims were completely unchallenged. And they went on to disqualify me as a candidate in the election of 2008. So I was watching with great interest how the numbers of people in this election of 2015 have been steadily rising. I think my last count was 22, but that might be out of date.
And just to clarify, did you ever have an opportunity, or did you feel that you had an opportunity to respond to the allegation before you were effectively dumped?
Oh, no. No, it all happened so quickly and without notice, really, that it was over before it started, really. There was nobody actually spoke to me about what had gone on.
How did you find out that you were being ejected?
I found out in a media scrum just out. Yes, I know. Imagine the delight. I was filming and for a little sort of video biography on my election website. And a huge little group of reporters came out waving a piece of paper, which turned out to be my dismissal as a candidate. I had no idea that was coming. So it was all captured on radio and television, which is a very unusual experience, to say the least.
Now, as I remember, we're seeing a lot of candidates in this 2015 election, experiencing the same thing. I mean, did you know back in 2008 you were kind of at the ground floor of a new phenomenon?
No, I didn't. Actually, there were too many other disastrous things to think about. But clearly, looking back, that was the case because the claim was anonymous. It was an unaccountable claim. It was not examined. Achieved the job of eliminating me as a candidate very successfully. Like I was over in no time. So what we've been seeing in 2015 is a lot more of the same, except that now I think it's probably a more popular approach. I think it has now become an established tactic in an election campaign, whereas previously I don't think people really recognized the power of what that could do.
Oh, okay. Maybe a kind of, your situation may have been like a kind of a dress rehearsal of sorts.
Exactly.
Well, it's interesting you talk about it as a tactic. What are some of the characteristics of that? I mean, assuming this is an apt description. What are some of the characteristics of this tactic?
Well, I think it's important to know that not only does this serve to the kinds of claims that are made against candidates, not only do they serve to humiliate the candidate and the candidate's party, or to expose that the candidate's party will not stand up for the candidate and therefore has no principles. It's a total lose-lose situation. But I think it's important to know that in some cases, the timing of these things is very important. The ideal time to squash a candidate is when it's too late to nominate another one. That whole nomination process takes time and organization. And so you want to do this at exactly the right time so that you eliminate the competition. You can imagine how appealing that would be to party strategists. And that was the case for me in my riding. 75,000, approximately 75,000 voters went without a Liberal candidate because it was just too late. Now that, imagine. And all of this costs no money, Michael. Think about that. Costs no money. It is so cost efficient. It's laughable.
I wanted to read another case study. This is someone from the 2015 election. He was running in the riding of Charleswood, St. James, Assiniboia. His name was Stefan Jonasson. He was running for the NDP. And he was essentially booted out because he compared the beliefs of the Haredim, an Orthodox branch of Judaism, to the Taliban with regards to the treatment of women. And, I mean, even some Jewish leaders have said that that's not an irresponsible thing to say. However, the candidate in an interview with CBC said that his comments were taken out of context by the True North Times, a website that has promised to expose controversial comments by 9 politicians in 9 days. So, Leslie, I guess my question is, what do you think that this episode and yours and others says about this phenomenon and its potentially corrosive impact on democracy?
Well, for one thing, it's much, much wider than simply causing a lot of pain to individuals and their families, right? Because this kind of public shaming sort of goes back to the tar and feathering in the public square, right, where all kinds of observers get to enjoy the process. So, but it goes much, much, much deeper than that. I think it goes to the heart of the democratic process, because imagine yourself interested in politics, wanting to make a contribution, being qualified to do that, and being prepared to take the risks and make the sacrifices that it requires, and there are many. And then you see another person who is completely trashed. How? What could we possibly expect that to do to the political process except to diminish it and to weaken it? So I think that people who enjoy seeing the disintegration of democracy particularly enjoy the whole candidate shaming game. But I think that it's so toxic and so dangerous, and the candidate that you just referred to was quite correct, that something has got to be done to qualify and expose how this really, really works.
Yeah, I know that I've heard about how there is a strategy involved with what they call the attack ads. You know, it turns people off to the point where they don't vote at all, and that will often favor the people that are in power that are looking
the
incumbents. And I'm wondering if this is a sort of a parallel situation here in terms of discouraging participation,
you're suggesting
both voters and the candidates.
That this could be one of the methods in voter repression. Right?
I suppose, yes.
Yeah, I would say that is correct. I don't think that is too an extreme an observation at all.
And at the end of this process, I mean, what kind of a crew of candidates will emerge if they know that they're going to be submitted to this kind of scrutiny? I mean, but not just scrutiny, but, you know, in some sense, unfair scrutiny. They're not going to have a chance to clarify, well, this is what I meant, you know, or this was what the context was.
Well, fair scrutiny is one thing, right? But you have to recall that many of us who are perfectly decent people have said stupid things, things we wish that we hadn't said, things in frustration, things in anger, things in immaturity. All of these imperfections do not necessarily mean that a person would not be a truly effective politician. As some of these revelations about character, for example, go back years and years. And you will often hear this from mature voters. They say, oh, thank God that I didn't grow up in the era of the social media, because I could have been labeled forever. When I think about things that I might have said and done that do not represent me, the evolving, the present me in any way, you know, it's just a stunning tactic overall.
Could you talk to that whole aspect of social media, which has the ability to capture and preserve and distribute and disseminate these sorts of, inconvenient quotes and whatnot, and while at the same time not having that same obligations that you would find from the more established media?
Well, you mentioned the established media, and I have to say that the social media reflects the worst practices of mainstream media. It's a mainstream media error writ large. And for example, the mainstream media is not really accountable. It's accountable to anybody who has a lot of money and time and patience. But for the average person, there is no accountability in mainstream media. And that is certainly the case in social media, where most people are anonymous and they're not prepared to own their opinions, to live up to them, or to defend them. Social media has picked up also the worst of the dysfunctional story. In mainstream media, the dysfunctional story is a story that doesn't really accomplish anything for the community. It's just meant to attract and divide. And often that's part of making money, right? You run a sensational story and you worry about the effects later because there may not be any. And social media does this superbly well, right? So you have the anonymity, you have your dysfunctional story. And I think also this is a perfect breeding ground for the half-truth, for given a lack of context and a lack of fact, it's so easy to conflate things, to conflate the 9/11 truth movement with anti-Semitism, for example, which I think is an argument that has been destroyed many times but continues to frighten people. Okay? So I think that all of these things need to be considered. Also, it's interesting to remember what John Ronson has said about the world of social media. He has written a very provocative and successful book recently called So You've Been Publicly Shamed, in which he points out that social media, which began as a democratizing environment where people could skip all the institutions and they could talk to each other honestly about things, make honest proposals about honest solutions to honest problems and so on, that whereas that may have been the beginning, what we have now, according to Ronson, and he is a sociologist who's done the homework, is a social media environment that is the equivalent of an angry child with poor impulse control, so that you never know when it's going to turn on you and you are no match for it in any case, in any circumstance.
You have no control.
No, and he points out, you know, how easy it is for good people to make mistakes on social media because it's wonderful to be part of a crowd because you get the reward of belonging for behaving as badly as everybody else. But you're not thinking about that. You're thinking about how nice it is to be part of a huge crowd of people, all of whom approve of you because you approve of them. Actually, he quoted, I think it was Voltaire, when he said, he also pointed out, you know, that a single snowflake never takes responsibility for the avalanche, right? And that's what we become on social media. So it's really unfortunate that this has become such a powerful and negative force in the electoral process.
Yeah, I mean, I find social media quite frustrating, actually, because you can see that sort of avalanche of facts or comments or whatever out there. And I mean, here I am trying to verify any of this stuff, and by the time I have, it's already passed, and I've been scooped.
It's too late.
So yeah. that begs the question, since we see social media now embedded in mainstream media, and mainstream media forced to kind of accommodate this, what is the impact on mainstream media coverage of our elections?
Oh, it's totally downhill. Speaking of avalanches, it is totally downhill. And I was going to give you just a quick example from my own experience, in that when my case was resolved, and I sent out press releases and an electronic press kit explaining the history of the story and how it had turned out, a local newsroom, local CBC newsroom, told the story incorrectly. It was just had to be a very, very bad, unusual day at the CBC. This was a shock to me. And they reported the outcome of my case inaccurately, saying that I had not settled with all three of the people I had sued, which I had, but that I had settled with only one. And they forgot to mention completely that I had been cleared of the charges. Well, this story then lost its impact completely. Who's interested in a five-year-old story where one partner has settled? Nobody. This caused a panic in a number of people who were familiar with my case. Many people were calling me to inform me about this. And the follow-up calls revealed that whoever was on the case was just new, inexperienced, and didn't understand the importance of having a legal document, which was attached to the press release. The legal document wasn't there. Here's the thing, though. Yahoo News picked the story up, and by the time we knew that it was the wrong story, it was all over the internet. It was impossible to correct. So the impact of the victory was completely lost. You can, and this is as a result of the social media feeding on mainstream news. Mainstream news also feeds on social media in exactly the same way. Inaccuracies are just rushed into print or broadcast. Isn't that amazing? Mm. It's really difficult to believe that this has happened. Here's what I'm hoping will happen, Michael. I'm hoping that some very, very prestigious, serious media platform will examine all of the discarded candidates in Canada in 2015, all of them, to find out exactly how accurate they were, what were the half-truths that came out of it, what was the impact of all of this in the riding and on the individual candidates. And I think that you'll find that this is a very systemic, strategic thing to do, that people are paid to do this smear kind of work, and that there are sites like possibly True North Times, about whom we need to know more. We always need to know who's funding a source. And in many cases, anonymous bloggers are able to do their work as a result of funding, and that is never disclosed. So I am really hoping that this will become a serious journalistic project in the not-too-distant future.
Okay, Leslie Hughes, I want to thank you very much for sharing those insights with us. I guess you're going to be looking to see with some anticipation about the results of this election.
I'll be watching. Indeed, I will.
Okay. Leslie Hughes is the author of the upcoming book, The Naked Canadian, A Dead Candidate's Report. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Michael Kiefer is a University of Guelph Emeritus Professor of Literary Studies. He's the author of Anti-Semitism, Real and Imagined, Responses to the Canadian Parliamentary Coalition to Combat Anti-Semitism, as well as an upcoming book that is tentatively called Sabotaging Democracy, Robocall Vote Suppression in Canada's May 2nd, 2011 Election. Professor Kiefer joins us from his home in Toronto. So, Professor Kiefer, you've been writing an essay, a multi-part essay that's been appearing in the Rabble blog, and it essentially details some of the elements of what you believe to have been essentially an interfered with or even a stolen election in 2011. I was wondering if you might want to just quickly outline for our audience some of the main points that you're making that convinces you that was, in fact, a stolen election.
Yes, I'll do that. The first thing to say is that we've been very badly served by the Canadian corporate media. There's been good investigative journalism by a handful of reporters, but the media response on the whole to what happened has demonstrated, I think, a kind of tragicomic level of political immaturity in this country. We were made the victims in 2011 of what I would call a state crime against democracy. That's not an original term at all. In other words, the evidence points very strongly and unambiguously to the Conservative Party of Canada as the organizer of a nationwide electoral fraud, a vote suppression fraud by telephone, a campaign that began during the 2011 election with harassment calls that were designed to irritate voters, that deceptively pretended to come, in most cases, from the Liberal Party, so they were intended to delegitimize and damage the Liberal Party in the eyes of voters. Those calls were then followed in the last days of the election and on election day by misinformation calls, some of them live, some of them automated or robocalls. The robocalls usually pretended to come from Elections Canada and to inform voters with regret, with apologies for the inconvenience, that their polling station had been changed. The idea being to misdirect people to faraway places in the hope that they would be too exhausted, too tired, too frustrated to actually get around to voting. Now, one of the ways the media let us down was by representing what happened as though it were simply a matter of pranksters or crank calls. Terms like that surfaced regularly in media reports, both at the time and more recently. We had reports of fraudulent telephone calls coming into Elections Canada from 261 of Canada's 308 ridings. Very evenly, unevenly distributed. I mean, there were only a few calls, it would seem, in some ridings, and there were torrents. There were tens of thousands of calls in others. But that alone is a kind of starting indication of something that was obviously nationally organized. It couldn't be an accident that people used the same kinds of techniques across the country in harassment telephone calls, and that they used nearly identical scripts for the misinformation calls. In other words, this was nationally organized, and the The scale of it was huge as well. We don't have evidence that's nearly as good as one would like to have, but what evidence we have from surveys made by two respected polling companies indicates that rather more than 1.1 million Canadians received fraudulent telephone calls during that election. Now, one of the things we know with a high degree of probability is that the calls were targeted, and the evidence points to the use of the Constituency Information Management System of the Conservative Party, the SIMS database, as the tool by which calls were targeted to, principally to opposition voters, so that they were deliberately setting out with the harassment calls to damage the reputation of opposition parties, and with the misinformation calls to suppress the vote of opposition parties more directly. Now, that's the kind of central part of what we need to know about what happened. We need to know that the scale of this was huge. If you think about it, spreading those calls, if they were spread evenly over the 261 ridings, which they weren't, that would mean every one of those ridings received a couple of thousand of harassment calls and at least a couple of thousand of misinformation calls targeted to opposition voters. We know that the calls actually focused on about on less than three dozen ridings, probably less than 30 ridings, including ridings that were known in advance of the election to be swing ridings. Now, as to evidence that it made a difference, there are a couple of studies that have a bearing on this. One by based on survey evidence from ECOS Research, which indicated an effect of, on average, in the ridings that were most intensely targeted, 1.5% vote suppression effect. Doesn't sound like much, but if you think of these ridings as being very often targeted swing ridings, a drop in 1.5% in opposition party voting can be more than enough to swing the results. Another study by Simon Fraser University economist Anke Kessler, using a completely different methodology, found that in the some two dozen ridings that were most affected by the fraudulent telephone calls, there was a vote suppression effect of approximately 2,000 voters. That's a slightly larger effect than the ECOS survey found. Once again, it's more than enough to swing the results in many ridings. And without going into detail, if you think that in the last election, the Conservative majority was based on 14 ridings in which the total, this sort of aggregate winning vote came to only 6,200 odd votes. We're looking at a situation in which it didn't take all that much to swing the results, to make the difference between re-election with a minority government and re-election as a majority government. Re-election with a majority in Parliament, which gives a prime minister who wants to be a tyrant enormous power. So that's the kind of central evidence, I think.
Now, I know that Elections Canada has a mandate to monitor the compliance with electoral legislation. When, you know, looking at not only at the 2011 election, but even the previous election, do you see any indications that Elections Canada may be falling short of its mandates and its responsibilities?
Yeah, well, one of the very first things the Conservatives did in their Accountability Act was to reduce the enforcement powers of Elections Canada, and they've reduced those powers much more significantly with the so-called Fair Elections Act of 2014. Elections Canada has done a poor job of enforcing the Canada Elections Act. In 2008, in what's now Elizabeth May's riding, I hope it remains her riding, of Saanich Gulf Islands in British Columbia.
That's the Green Party
riding
leader.
Was then, I'm sorry?
That's the Green Party leader.
That's the Green Party, yes. Yeah. Yes. I think she's a very effective parliamentarian and contributes significantly to the kind mm-hmm. of level of political discourse in this country. But in 2008, the riding was held by then Minister of Natural Resources, Gary Lunn. And he was in danger of getting defeated when, shortly before the election, the NDP candidate had to withdraw, which meant, because it was so close to the election, that his name remained on the ballot. But it also meant that the Liberal candidate had a strong chance of winning the kind of homeless votes of NDP supporters in the riding. Now, in the previous election, the NDP had actually had slightly more votes than the Liberal candidate. It's very much a kind of three-way split between Conservatives, Liberals, and NDP in that riding during the last decade. Now, what happened is that the riding was flooded on the day before the election with robocalls urging people to vote for the NDP candidate. And these calls had a spoofed callback number. They pretended to come from the NDP Riding Association. There's polling evidence that before those calls, less than 1% of voters in Saanich Gulf Islands intended to vote NDP. In other words, people knew that they had no candidate. Most people did. There were only a few who remained kind of resolutely uninformed. But the robocall had a significant effect. 5.7% of the voters in that riding voted for a non-candidate. They voted NDP, basically flushing their votes down the toilet. So 4.7% of the electorate was deceived by those robocalls. And if you take the NDP vote in the preceding election of 2006 as a kind of marker of that party's support, something like 18% of NDP voters were deceived by the robocalls into basically wasting their vote. Now, the interesting thing about that, apart from what it demonstrates about the potential power of telephone fraud victimizing a public that hasn't previously been exposed to it, the interesting thing is that the RCMP refused to take any action. They said no law had been broken, which was, of course, completely false. It's against the criminal code to carry out fraud by telephone or to impersonate people by telephone. And Elections Canada said, we can't find out who did it, and we can't find anybody who was actually deceived by these calls, which is a complete confession of investigative incompetence. And they then said impudently that they did not believe that any law had been broken, which is a pretty flagrant falsehood. Now, what that told the people who carried out that fraud, obviously supporters of Gary Lunn, quite probably agents of the Conservative Party, what that told them is that they could get away scot-free with serious electoral fraud. And I think that may have incited the Conservatives to the national effort that they put into electoral fraud in 2011.
You brought up the RCMP's role just now in not investigating, saying there was no indications of criminality. But you as you pointed out in your series of essays, and as we've pointed out on this news show, the RCMP have had it seems to be interfering with regular government processes, not just elections, but whether we're talking about the 2006, where they decided to start investigating the Liberal finance minister at a critical moment in the campaign.
And yes, that had a decisive impact on that election, and is one sign of serious corruption in the RCMP, because they announced an investigation not merely of Ralph Goodale's office, but of Ralph Goodale himself. And this was the cabinet minister who, above all others, in that faltering Liberal government, who had the reputation for being a straight arrow, for being decent and honest and above board. And the effect of that was very marked. In Ontario, the polls showed a swing from an 18% Liberal lead to a 6% Conservative lead. So I think it's arguable that that was a decisive factor in that election. Perhaps along with the In-N-Out scandal that the Conservatives perpetrated, which was a clear example of financing fraud in an election.
You've also got the issue of like when they have the terror arrests, for example, and then they just tend to have these conferences where they just announce it, and it always seems to be at a critical time when there's some legislation being passed. I've commented on this show, for example, how the day before the Commons vote on Bill C-51, we saw a leak of information from the RCMP about how there were going to be a terror attack against the West Edmonton Mall, and that was running all day long. And I mean, it seems like you've got a bit of a pattern there. I mean, is it taking things a little bit too far to suggest that maybe there's some kind of RCMP government collusion happening?
No, I think it's transparently clear that there is a corrupt engagement in Canadian politics on the part of the RCMP. And it's clear that the RCMP is corrupt in other ways as well. I mean, back in, I think it was 2007, there was that never properly investigated scandal involving their pension fund. Senior RCMP officers appear to have looted the RCMP pension fund and got away with it. So it's a seriously corrupt organization, and I think one can probably suggest that its corruption spreads in various directions, and that the blame for that corruption should be spread wider than just within the senior ranks of the RCMP. I mean, if you think that after Canada in 2004 helped to overthrow the democratic government of Haiti, the RCMP took on responsibility for training the Haitian National Police. And one then saw clear evidence that the Haitian National Police was running death squads who were murdering people with sniper fire in pro-democracy demonstrations in Port-au-Prince and elsewhere. So the RCMP was in effect responsible for that kind of criminality. And I think when you put a national police force into that sort of situation and allow or encourage them to participate in that kind of criminality, you're asking for trouble at home.
Now, you framed all of this, this series of essays you've written, or are writing, because it still hasn't all come out yet, in the under the umbrella of state crimes against democracy, as I see it, or at least that's how you framed it in an earlier...
Yes, in an essay I published at Global Research, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. So, have you been able to ascertain any patterns throughout, like, what through this... series of electoral fraud, like when you're talking about state crimes against democracy, which can encompass a lot of different methods, what are the familiar patterns that you're seeing here that you've seen in other instances in the United States, for example?
Well, there's an excellent book by an American political scientist, Lance DeHaven Smith, who teaches in the Florida university system. Conspiracy Theory in America, University of Texas Press, published a couple of years ago. And conspiracy theory is, of course, the term that is used to immobilize critical discourse directed toward an exploration of state crimes against democracy. So he's concerned to advance the term state crimes against democracy in opposition to that kind of silencing rhetoric. He points out that state crimes against democracy in the United States have tended very much to be clustered around elections, whether it's assassinations or other kinds of criminality. They're very often aimed at working the levers of power through the manipulation of the electoral system, either by getting rid of people who are threatening candidates to the interests of the perpetrators of this kind of crime, or by fraudulently altering the results of the system, or by fraudulently suppressing the vote of typically minority voters, Hispanic voters, black voters. I think one of the central things about state crimes against democracy is that that's what they tend to focus on. In other words, one of the central features of representative democracies, the electoral system.
Now, is this then a question of one corrupt party then, or are there other external influences involved, U.S.-based or elsewhere?
Well, in the United States, I mean, the two major parties are, of course, great sort of coalition umbrellas of disparate interests, but they do, one can call them wings of the same bloody bird, if you like, but they do have significant differences in orientation in at least some respects. And one of the obvious things to say about the Republican Party, with its interest in policies that tend to be in the interests of the well-to-do and to disfavor the interests of working people, is that they're acutely aware that because of their policy orientations, they're never going to achieve majority support. In other words, they have a kind of inbuilt pressure on them to fiddle and corrupt the electoral system. And that's what they've been very vigorously doing for at least the last quarter century. Mm. I don't think that there has been... I mean, there's actually very good evidence that American presidential elections in particular have been systematically fiddled and corrupted since the 1980s.
Okay. Well, Professor Kiefer, I'm just wondering then what your thoughts are about recent reports from the last round of advance voting, reports about pre-marked ballots, where there was the Elections Canada official, I think his name was John Enright, a spokesman said that this was like a printing error and just happened to get a little bit of ink onto one of the spaces next to the names of certain candidates, but basically these were essentially considered spoiled ballots, and if someone tried to vote with one of those, it would be considered spoiled. You know, I'm thinking of this as maybe Canada's hanging Chad scenario. What are your thoughts? Is it over the top to suggest that maybe this is the next round of fraudulent behavior?
No, I don't think so, because, I think that at the very least, there is evident moral corruption within Elections Canada. If one looks at the report with which the Commissioner of Canada Elections, Yves Côté, who is the official responsible within Elections Canada for enforcing the Canada Elections Act. The report in April 2014, with which he closed down his investigation of electoral fraud in the 2011 election, Summary Investigation Report on Robocalls was the title of it. He claims, for example, that his investigators were unable to find evidence of criminal intention, and therefore there's no point carrying out a prosecution because if there's no evidence of intention, then you can't convict any, you can't hope to convict anybody under the Canada Elections Act. Now, the evidence in his own report flagrantly contradicts that conclusion in multiple ways. One of the most obvious ones being simply this. Elections Canada collected 2,448 complaints about fraudulent telephone calls. They actually received far more complaints, but they weren't very assiduous in keeping records until at least the middle of 2012. 2,448 complaints, evenly divided, 51% to 49%, between complaints over harassment calls and complaints over polling station misinformation calls. Now, here's the surprising thing. 2,448 complaints, but 1,726 complainants. That's a bit of a surprise. You think about it, what that means, unambiguously, is that 42% of the people who received or who complained about fraudulent phone calls received both kinds of calls.
Hmm.
Now, ask any statistician, ask anyone who's you know, taken a one-semester, first-year course on statistics, that's evidence of intention. That's evidence that many of the people who were targeted for one kind of call were being targeted for both kinds of calls. And there's a great deal more within the report that similarly shows up the how fatuous the claims made by the Commissioner of Canada Elections were. So that tells one that in a very senior position in that organization, you have somebody who is actively not interested in doing his duty and enforcing the law. Should it be any surprise then that there might be people elsewhere in the organization who are engaged in lesser forms of, let's call it, moral corruption? I think not.
Mm. Professor Kiefer, you've brought forward some very provocative points in your series of essays and over the course of this conversation. I want to thank you very much for sharing these very important points with us. And as we are in the lead up to Election Day as we record this conversation, but perhaps we can have a bit of a look back in the next week or two just to see, well, what happened and what it means.
Yes, that's always interesting to do a bit of a postmortem and see whether any new forms of corruption have manifested themselves.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for having me on the program.
We've been speaking with University of Guelph Emeritus Professor of Literary Studies, Michael Kiefer. Professor Kiefer's analysis of fraud in the 2011 election is available at rabble.ca and on the Global Research website. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.